welcome to another edition of She Persisted here on the Progressive Voices Network. My name is Melissa Carter. Royal wedding. Now, we do have a guest today, so I'm going to ask her about it too. Dr. Iyabo will be joining us soon. She has a book called Permanent Happiness. She's a physician and she's a badass. So stay tuned for that. But first, let's talk about the royal wedding. Now, you are going to have to forgive me because I am not the girl that looks at all the outfits. Okay? And I'm not sure that has anything to do with the fact I'm a lesbian. I don't want to stereotype because there's plenty of lesbians that's into fashion. I just think on a personal human level, I have never been that interested in fashion. I do know what I like to look at. I mean, like I just think that Princess Kate is so beautiful. So I think she looks beautiful in anything. And I think that Meghan's mom looked phenomenal. I loved that color on her. And I thought that Queen Elizabeth always looks flawless, but Meghan's dress, I mean, again, I don't know about styles and stuff. I know she was paired with a designer. She picked the designer and she, you know, and I loved it. I loved how it wasn't very ornate. I loved it. I thought the guys looked great. So I can't comment on the fashion. Okay, so that's not what I want to talk about. But I'm just gonna tell it like it is, right? There's a lot of black people there, and that was fantastic. Like the thing that I loved about it was the fact that these people hadn't seen anything like that. I thought the United States has moved to England. I thought you had a black preacher. You had a black choir. They made sure that every black person they could fit into that ceremony was in that ceremony. I mean, from the guy who, he was an accomplished British musician, but of course he's black. I mean, I'm just telling it like it is. I just thought it was hilarious because I loved it because I thought the camera kept showing people in the audience. Did you notice this or was it just me when the Reverend was up there? He was so expressive. It just reminded me about the fact that how British people, especially in these ceremonial type things, especially the royals, tend to be so, you know, buttoned up and tight-lipped. And he was just looking around at people like, you listening to me? You listening to me? With his arms. And I just thought they had not seen anything like this. Now, I may be stereotyping. There's probably plenty of cool people in there. But the camera was panning people, and you saw the eye glances back and forth. Oh my God, it was hilarious. So that's my favorite part. I thought that this ceremony, I mean, at my age, I think Charles and Diana were my first. I was 10 when they got married, so that was my first royal wedding, a royal big ceremony. And then Fergie's wedding I watched, and Diana and Charles, and looking back on theirs, of course, that's going to be my all-time favorite because it's my first. But her dress was so poofy, like it was so 80s that looking back on it, I mean, Diana is just flawless, but the dress was not my favorite of the crew. But I love that. I'm the biggest fan of the pomp and circumstance. I love the traditions, and I'm big Anglophile, and I love the fact that Meghan's ring had some of Diana's jewels in it, and that I believe the tiara was from Diana's family. And, you know, obviously Kate has the Diana's wedding ring and engagement ring on, or at least engagement ring. And so I love that kind of stuff. So the jewelry stuff I will pay attention to. I thought Meghan looked great. I kind of like the fact that she wasn't put together perfectly, because her hair was not perfect. So I don't know. There were pieces out of place, and I thought it kind of fit because I felt that Harry and Meghan were able to be. I mean, they still had to be traditional because he still is an heir to the throne, but I mean, far down the line, and he doesn't have to have the same regalness necessarily as William did, because William will be king, where Harry, you know, won't. The funny thing is, I have a friend who was, you know, asking me, are you into this? Are you getting into this like you do normally? And you know, I didn't do things through the week and I didn't get any souvenirs or anything. I had a friend give me some William and Kate souvenirs because she was covering the wedding in England. She in media, a friend of mine in media. So she got me some little tchotchke stuff, but I didn't get anything for Harry and Meghan's. So during the week, I didn't do a lot of stuff because I normally, like, when those shows on PBS or BBC America are on about the royals, I'm watching it anyway. I'm addicted to The Crown. I love all that stuff. So to me, I felt like, well, what would I do that I, you know, more so than I already do normally? But I thought, I'm going to record it. I don't know if I'm going to set the alarm to get up, because for Charles and Diana, I did set the alarm to get up. William and Kate, I got up early. For Diana's funeral, I got up early. But I thought, I had Mr. Carter, and if you have ever been around a toddler, like, I wasn't going to do anything to wake him up early. I wanted him to sleep as long as possible because that just makes your life easier. And so I thought, well, I'll just sleep in and then we'll see. Well, I woke up on my own about 5:30, and I thought, well, you know, it's on. So I turned the TV on and I thought, well, let me grab a shower before my son wakes up. And so I got in the shower, I came out of the shower, and I still hadn't missed anything. So I thought, oh, okay, I'm good. And so I laid in bed while he was asleep and watched most of it. And then he woke up and I tried to get him to understand what was going on. He didn't care. My son didn't care about that stuff. So I was able to play with Thomas the Tank Engine while Harry and Meghan were getting married over his shoulder. So I got to see it without making my son too mad about my distraction at looking at the wedding. But I tried to show him, oh, well, that's a princess just like Elsa, because he's seen Frozen. And I'm like, and that's a prince. But he maybe kept his attention for 20 seconds when I said, it's like Elsa. I said, oh, yeah, she's a princess. What's that on her head? So I had to try to explain what a veil was. And then he was back to the train. So, but one of the things I texted a friend of mine during the ceremony, because I know that everybody was so excited. It wasn't the fact that Meghan was an American. It was the fact that Meghan was part of a family that was integrated. So she had a black mama. Let's just be honest. That's why everybody was so excited. Again, her mother looked wonderful. I just loved that color on her. Anyway, and so I told my friend, I said, you know, this is better than I expected. Because there was a part of me that felt that there was an expectation that was not going to be fulfilled. I got to be honest with you. There's a part of me that felt like the African-American community was so excited that this was such a monumental event, that the royal family was now going to have a black woman in the mix, like in their family. Meghan's mom is now part of the family. And I thought they're going to be disappointed because there's not going to be much honoring of that, is what I thought, because I had not read any of the plans or any of the things that might happen at the ceremony. So I was behind because I had not prepped for the wedding like my friend had. So when there was a black minister, I was shocked. When there was a black choir, I was shocked. Like, I was shocked that there, and that's why I texted her. I'm like, and my friend happens to be black, and I texted her and I said, they have never seen this before. Like, these uptight white English people have never seen this. Rich have never seen this before. So I thought this wedding blew every other wedding out of the water when it came to that. And then I thought, well, only Harry could pull that off, because, I mean, Harry's always been kind of the wild child. And so sometimes it takes the quote unquote wild child to introduce or to pull people and their surroundings into modern era, because people expect them to be wild, quote unquote. The wedding was great because I was so thrilled that there was inclusion in that ceremony and that it was phenomenal. And so congratulations to them. I texted my friend, I said, well, will I ever live to see the day where there's an openly gay member of the royal family? Because come on, people. I mean, you, the only royal, if you're an Anglophile, that was pretty much known to be homosexual. And of course, now that I'm acting like I know all about English history and I forgot his name, but Mary, Queen of Scots' son. So, you know, back in the day, Queen Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots, and they were battling over the throne, and Mary, Queen of Scots was killed. And anyway, her son took the throne after Elizabeth I, because Elizabeth didn't have any children. So a Scotsman did end up taking the throne. He was James, maybe, but he was known to be homosexual. So that's the only one I've ever heard that that people knew. And so I'm thinking, I'll never see a ceremony like that for two men or two women. Unfortunately, I'll never live to see that day. But someday it'll happen. Someday it'll happen. It's just a shame that it took, what is it, 2018? And this is the first time we've had a black choir and a black preacher in a royal ceremony. But we'll get there. We'll get there. Somebody in that family is gay. Somebody in that family has been gay. There are plenty who have been gay and have been forced to get married because it's the right thing to do for the royal family and to continue the line or whatever. I'm going to ask Dr. Yabo how she feels about that and some comments that were made during the ceremony. So comments from, I watched the Today Show, I watched the NBC commentators, and there was one phrase that several of them kept saying that I thought, is that a little old-fashioned? But I will talk to Dr. Yabo about that before we go.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, every Monday and Thursday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday,
you can hear us from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
John Kelly asked about separating migrant families at the border, says they don't integrate well. They don't have skills.
What?
I'm sorry. Does Trump go to Racists Are Us to get employees in his administration? Mr. Kelly, have you ever had a salad or a glass of wine? They used their skills for that. Here in California, their skills take care of our children, our landscaping, painting, construction, and by the way, numerous other jobs. These people work hard. I lived in Mexico years ago. They work, first of all, every Latino that I know who is not college educated and is working, a hard labor type of job. They work 6 days a week. I have often seen them here and when I lived in Mexico work, and I'm not exaggerating, 14-hour days. And on Sundays, they work, but maybe not for money. Maybe doing their own yard, cleaning their own house, taking care of their own children, of course, going to church and spending time with their own families, as they should. They work really hard, and they have a lot of skill sets. On the administration's recently announced zero-tolerance policy that calls for separating families who cross the border illegally and prosecuting them. Let me explain something. Abandonment is a huge issue for children. I have two children. My son is adopted, and my daughter is not. And my son right now is going through some very difficult times being adopted and with questions about his birth mother and his identity. We all want identity. It's the reason people call themselves African-Americans, Mexican-Americans. It's the reason some people celebrate Cinco de Mayo or have a Polish parade in Chicago or a St. Patty's Day parade. We want identity to our families and to our past. And when you rip a child from its mother, you are doing irreparable emotional and mental and perhaps even physical damage. And that, by the way, is not just my opinion. It is fact. Look it up. Shame on us. Who the hell do we think we are? Okay? Let me step back and tell you that the vast majority of the people that move illegally into the United States are not bad people. They're not criminals. They're not MS-13. Do you know that we have had Mexicans in this country, whether legally or illegally, since most of us has been here because California was once part of Mexico? They haven't assimilated? Yes, they have. Anyway, he says they're overwhelmingly rural people. In the countries they come from, fourth, fifth, sixth grade educations are kind of the norm. They don't speak English. Obviously, that's a big thing. They don't integrate well. They don't have skills. We don't speak anything but English. And if you ask anybody in the UK, we don't speak that well. Most people I know speak some English that come from Mexico. He said, they're coming here for a reason. They're not bad people. They're coming here for a reason. I sympathize with the reason, but the laws are the laws. The big point is they elected to come illegally into the United States. And this is a technique that no one hopes will be used extensively or for very long. I would enter a country illegally if I were hungry, if I felt threatened, if I could not feed my family. And you know, you all would as well. Every hateful, stereotypical, and racist thing John Kelly said about Mexican Americans was said about every other immigrant group that ended up building this country.
Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Thursday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Make one more plea to people about customer service before we get to our guest. I still don't have a dishwasher, by the way. I don't know if you heard my rant about a company that I probably will end up having to name because it's been such a debacle. I still don't have my refund. I still don't have a dishwasher washing dishes by hand. But it's not just about that. I just have noticed that people, I don't know. Maybe it's just because I'm looking for it, but customer service, just people not caring about what they do for a living. That I appreciate living in an environment where people are more concerned about their personal lives and their professional lives. Like I don't want to go back to the point where, and some people still live this way, but go back to a point where your professional lives are so important that you sacrifice everything for it. I think we're trying to kind of get out of that, where we're asking companies to be more considerate of our personal lives. I've heard of companies now that have nap rooms to where if you are exhausted, go into the nap room, take a quick nap and come out. Like, you know, companies are starting to care about their employees, or at least attempt to try to care about their employees a little bit. But I feel like we're trading off when you're taking the pressure off of people that their reputation, their work is not necessarily define their lives anymore, that we're taking off this sense of responsibility. Because I don't care what you do. I don't care what I do. I don't care whether I'm flipping burgers or whether I'm a CEO. Everywhere in between, and no offense to burger flippers for putting you on the bottom of the list there, but I'm just thinking of wages, that we don't care about what we do. So we're going from work being everything to almost being like, you're just biding your time until you get off the clock. And that's everybody. That's not just this stupid place that I bought the dishwasher from, but I took my son to a place in the Metro Atlanta area. I don't want to name names if I'm complaining, but like it's not a resort, but it's a place to go. It has an inn, and it's a very country atmosphere. And there were people there that really did care about what they did. And then I ran again into some people that didn't care about what they did. And I just feel like it's happening so often, whether it's, I've seen it at fast food that I've gone to, I've seen it at an art supply store that I've gone to, it seems like restaurants I've gone to, it just seems like it's consistent. It's not just a once in a time thing where I'm coming across somebody that I can't believe how stupid they're being at their job, how they're not trying. To me, stupidity is when you know better. And I don't know. I just feel like let's look at what you chose what you're doing for a living. Even if it's not your dream job, you chose to be there. Nobody forced you to take that job. So you are in the job that you are in because you chose to be there. So you've got to give a shit. I want everybody to start caring about what they're doing, because I just really think that it seems like our country is almost becoming a place we don't want to be in anymore. From the violence to people not caring to, I don't know what it is, but I just feel like we've got to turn this somehow to where we create an environment for ourselves, let alone for everybody else, that we want to be in. I want to be in your restaurant. I want to be at your inn. I want to be in your store. but I don't want to be there anymore if you're just going to kind of be an asshole or be dismissive or not know what you're doing if I ask you a question. Like, where's hiring qualified applicants? I feel like everybody's just turning stupid. I got to be honest with you. And again, to me, stupidity means you know better, but you don't try. Being ignorant to something is completely different. I think stupidity is you are just being fucking lazy, and I'm fucking tired of it. Like, all of us have got to get out there and grind, and so maybe it's good that you're being fucking lazy because that means those of us who are ambitious and hardworking will excel faster. I don't know. But to be in your company is really irritating, and to waste my time because you can't do your fucking job, it's just a grind. So that's my little shout out to people. Like, just whoever's listening, just check yourself first. Make sure you're doing what you need to be doing. And then encourage other people to do what they need to be doing. And if you're a manager, don't hire people that can't fucking do the job. Just don't do it. Just hire good people. There are good people out there. I'm hoping there's still people who care. But I'm not seeing them as often. And it's just really concerning me that I don't want this country to become a place that I want to leave. And I'm afraid that we're getting to that point, and I don't want it to continue. Okay. So we do have a guest. I'm very excited. Somebody who does give a shit about her job, by the way, somebody who's very good at her job. Dr. Iyabo is a physician here in the Atlanta area. But she has a long history of being a physician in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. And she has written a new book called Permanent Happiness. And I know that's something that a lot of women are seeking. So please welcome to the show, Dr. Iyabo. Now, last weekend, the big event was the royal wedding. So did you watch it?
Oh, yes, I did. I was glued to my TV. I watched it.
I told a friend that I thought that this might be the best royal wedding I'd ever seen because of the fact that it was so inclusive of so many different types of people, for both on the outside of the castle and inside of the castle and inside of the church. But one of the references I kept hearing the announcers talk about is that this is the dream for every woman, that this is every little girl's dream, is what Meghan Markle, her Royal Highness, the Duchess of Sussex, underwent on Saturday. So I kind of want you to talk a little bit about women and whether that royal wedding where you get the prince of your dreams and all these things, is that a viable dream for little girls to have, or was that maybe a little bit old fashioned?
It's definitely viable. It's a viable dream for every girl, whether, a little girl or even older girls like myself, because, of course, I'm single. I've been divorced for 9 years. It's a viable dream to have. Who doesn't want to be with their prince? Who doesn't want to be with, a man that they've fallen in love with, who adores them and who they also adore? That should be, every girl's dream. However, we should still make sure that we're teaching our girls that you're not going to be able to find that everlasting love or everlasting happiness if you haven't done the work for yourself. And I feel like Meghan has done that. I mean, obviously, I don't know her, but from stories I've read, I feel like she's found her passion. She's found what really makes her tick. And that's really how she found her love, because I think she's an ambassador for world peace. So she's doing some work worldwide, and I'm not really sure what, but I think she does some work in Africa and all that. Just really living out her passion, and that's how she found Prince Harry. So for every girl, I would like to say, yes, you should have that dream. I still have that dream of finding my prince. Of course, I'm dating now. I'm in a relationship. But I would say, okay, little girls, young girls, have that dream. But also remember that the number one dream you should have is finding your passion, finding that thing that really makes you feel like you're part of this universe. And then while you're living out that passion, trust me, you will find that prince. And then you can both really be happy together. But I don't want us to teach little girls that that's the only, that's the main dream they should have, finding that prince. You get what I'm saying, Melissa? I really feel it's important that they find that happiness first.
With the wedding and with Meghan in particular, one of the things that she requested was that she not be given away, for instance. So even though her father couldn't make the ceremony, mm-hmm. and the Prince of Wales was escorting her down the aisle, that he did not give her, nobody mm-hmm. gave her away. So to your point, I think think that it is something that we all were glued to, and it's so romantic and it's so wonderful. But at the same time, it's not just romantic because he's living his life and he came and scooped you up and rescued you from yours. It's like you said,
I know,
women have to have their own life, and you become partners with your prince rather than someone who's going to save you.
Absolutely. That's key. That's important.
Well, and then going to your profession, let's talk a little bit about your background, because I talk to on the podcast a lot to women about making sure that, yes, you find your passion and that you also think about making your life self-sustainable, not only from that passion stance, but also from a financial stance. So let's talk a bit about your background and why you chose what you do.
Okay, so I was born in Lagos, Nigeria. I was born and raised there. I lived in Nigeria till I was 22, almost 23, before I moved to England. And I studied medicine in England. I was really good with the science subjects, of course. And, you know, it's a natural trend. You know, you're good with the sciences. Your parents, you know, try to talk you into being a doctor. And I actually really wanted to be a doctor. I had an uncle who was a neurosurgeon at the time who, you know, would visit us at home, and we talked about medicine. And, you know, I just found myself really starting to love the idea of medicine. And I got into med school, and I finished medical school in Lagos. But I had this dream of, you know, moving to Europe and practicing medicine there, which I did. I had visited England several times as a little kid, so I really just wanted to move there to practice, which I did when I was 22. And I practiced there for almost 5 years, but I had bigger dreams. I really wasn't reaching the level I wanted to be professionally in England. I felt a little stuck, so I decided to move to the nation of big dreams, to the States, of course. And I did that. I had to do residency all over again, even though I had finished residency in England. And, you know, you have to do what you have to do. I was a little disappointed that I had to do it all over again, but I understood I was moving from one system to another system. So I did residency for another 3 years. And they did recognize, you know, my experience and all that. So in my final year, I was lucky to be made chief resident. So I didn't have so many clinical duties at that point. It was more of a leadership administrative role. And I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I watched my parents. They were a lovely couple. My dad was the best dad ever. They had a wonderful relationship. Obviously not free of flaws or not free of, you know, little things here and there, but they had a well-balanced, loving relationship. They worked well together. They were both business-minded. And I saw that, and I knew that whatever I was going into, I also wanted to be an entrepreneur and just be that kind of strong woman that my mom was. My mom was really strong. So was my dad. But my dad was strong in the way that I feel is opposite to what the normal culture tells us. I feel sometimes we feel strong men are the ones who are overpowering. But no, my dad was actually very gentle, very humble, and I feel that's where his strength was. I really feel that men who are gentle and humble actually display strength in a very special way, and that's what I saw between both of them. I wanted to have the kind of relationship they had. I wanted to be a strong woman and entrepreneur like my parents, especially like my mom. My mom was elegant. She was beautiful, strong, and she was just this woman that I admired. She could neither speak nor write English, but I'm telling you, she was the most beautiful woman, most confident woman. She was very successful. So that's how my journey started. So I moved to the States, and I had this dream of opening my own practice, which I did. So I was in New York for 3 years, from 1998 to 2001, completed my residency, moved to Atlanta in 2001, and I opened my practice in 2004. And it's still open today, and it's a successful practice.
Is there anything you see consistently in your female patients that, you know, any advice that you give to women about their own health, anything they're not doing that you would reach out to them now and tell them?
So I'm a pediatrician. I see kids from 0 to 21. It's a very broad, very wide age base. So I think the question you're asking me, I'll answer that in the context of teenagers and youth and young adults, since I don't really see adults per se. Yeah, but what I would say to young females at that age, at the age group that I see, is take care of yourself. Take care of your health. You know, make sure that you're the number one advocate for yourself. You know, eat healthy, make sure you're active, drink a lot of water. A lot of teenagers don't drink water. They tend to, you know, just walk around dehydrated. Again, some are overweight, and I also try to tell them it's not about the way you look, it's about the way you feel. You know, you have to make sure that you feel good, you feel healthy, you feel confident. So I'm not saying everybody has to be a size 0 or size 4 or size 6, but just make sure you're making healthy choices and that you're active and, you know, you just feel good about yourself. I talk about health on one hand, and then I also talk about mental health and psychological health a lot, because as we know, there's a lot of teasing and bullying and all that going on. So I always make sure I start with, you're a beautiful girl. Everybody's unique and beautiful in their own way. So I'm not talking to you because I'm telling you about your exterior. I'm talking to you because I want you to be happy from inside out and healthy from inside out. So that's, I try to work on my patients from inside out. I talk to them. I don't focus. We already have enough in the media telling us about how women should look, right. Whether you should be tall or thin or, you know, that I don't do that in my practice. I just want to make sure that they're confident from the inside out. Those are the things I focus on. And then again, because of the age group I deal with, I talk a lot about sexual health. Mm-hmm. I do, because there's a lot of negative practices out there that women, that young girls are, you know, getting involved in. So I talk about reproductive health, safe sexual practices, abstinence. I still talk about abstinence. I still tell them that's the number one choice. And I still talk about everything else, condoms, and just making sure that they practice safe sex. So those are the three main ones, you know, health, physical health, like we talk about, and then mental health from inside out, and then safe sexual practices also.
Dr. Abu, I'm curious about your thought about this, because I've mentioned on the show before that I think sometimes women start losing their voice, it seems, around puberty, because somehow when it comes to sexuality, especially if they're heterosexual, that they feel that their bodies are in the hands of the men or the boys, that they are the virgins, and then the guys are going to come and take their virginity or whatever. There's just this language and this idea, at least it used to be, that you kind of are the beta to the alpha, that is the male that comes into that situation. Do you find that with young girls now, or do you think that they are more in touch with their sexuality and more in power with their sexuality?
I think it's evolving. Honestly, I think it's getting better. They are getting to be more confident with their sexuality. I think they are, for sure. I mean, it's still 50-50. It really depends, again, on the kind of environment they live in, the kind of influences they're around. It's such a complex mix of influences. So again, in my practice, I just try to tell them that your body is yours. Don't feel that a guy is going to love you anymore if you have sex with him, or if he tells you that he loves you from the morning. But your body is yours. So just make sure that you have a solid relationship first, and don't feel like sex is the number one thing that you have to get involved in. Because I just feel that young girls, teenagers at that age feel like you said, you know, there's this strong guy who's coming in, and I'm a virgin, and, you know, if I give him my virginity or whatnot, then he's going to love me more, or he's going to feel wonderful about me. And I tell them that's actually opposite. So be very careful about that. Be careful about what you're doing before you do. You know, you can have a nice relationship without even involving sex at all, because that's yours. That's something that, you know, you keep to yourself until you really feel you're ready to, you know, to give it away. Don't feel like it's a gift for a guy and he's going to love you or keep you forever because you've had sex with him and, you know, you lost your virginity to him. So it's evolving. I think it just depends on the kind of influences they're around. Obviously, you know, kids have to be around good influences. They have to be around strong, confident women to be able to get those kinds of traits. So it's evolving, but we're not there yet.
What brought you to, or what was the catalyst, rather, for you to write Permanent Happiness?
So the catalyst was, I've talked about my dad. The catalyst really was my dad's passing. I was just talking to a friend a couple of days ago that it's amazing how I had such a wonderful dad while he was living. He was such a wonderful influence and impact in my life. And then even after he was gone, he was still influencing me, because I believe it was that deep connection we had that continued after he passed. And I honestly didn't start off with the objective of writing a book. I was just journaling. This was 2 months after he passed. He passed in October 2015. And in December, you know, I just started, I picked up a book and I was just going to start writing down my feelings. And I feel like a voice was telling me to pick up my laptop instead of my book. And I just started typing. And that's how I started writing Permanent Happiness. So Permanent Happiness really was just me wanting to put all my thoughts down about how much of an influence my dad was in my life. And then I just didn't stop until 2 months after I was done writing about 50,000 words and it was a book, you know. Yeah, so it was some kind of, I don't know, some kind of spiritual effect or something that was going on in me. And I just, someone said I was channeling. I don't really understand channeling, but it sounds right. Maybe that's what was going on in me.
Maybe.
Then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to any possibilities. Yeah. But I also think that it's important for some, you know, because I'm assuming your book would be categorized as a nonfiction book and it like a self-help book. And for some, you can almost sense that there is, I don't know, you can tell the authenticity of books that are told from the heart, like obviously your book is told from, as opposed to those who just are trying to make some money off people who are feeling vulnerable and decide that they're going to write a self-help book. You know what I mean? Because I do think there's some people that brand that because they think it's the easy route. But for you to share your feelings and your innermost thoughts at such a challenging time for you because of the mourning of someone who's so important to you, what is somebody who is not a part of your life, what are they going to get out of this book?
Oh, a lot. The feedback I've gotten from this book is so overwhelming and it just gives me goosebumps every time. The other day, my handyman was telling me he read my book. He read my book and he was just so moved by it. So I think the number one thing that I can, that people will get from my book, from all the feedback that I've gotten, that I keep getting from men, women, and people of all ages, is being vulnerable is not easy. But if you want to have freedom in life, you have to be vulnerable. You have to be vulnerable at times and you have to be authentic. Because at the end of the day, we all have things we go through. But, you know, you have to get to that point where you feel you want to share. But I'm not saying everybody should share. I'm not saying, okay, everybody start sharing every detail about your life. If you're not ready to share and you get, you know, some feedback, you may not be able to handle it. But the main thing is I was vulnerable. People were able to connect with my vulnerability, my authenticity, and just seeing that, well, I'm not a perfect human being. Like some of my friends have said, like, oh, we didn't know you were going through all that. Oh, yeah, but we didn't know you were, you know, all that was going on. I'm like, yes, it was going on. But at least now I'm glad I'm able to share. So that's the number one thing that I want people to get. And then, of course, the main thing is we can actually have permanent happiness, which is peace. I'm not saying happiness jumping up and down, dancing for joy every day. That's not going to happen. But permanent happiness just means having that contentment, having that peace that no matter what is going on outside of you, you're able to handle it from inside out.
And you talk about vulnerability. Well, you think about the closest friendships are based on two people who have spent so much time together that they know each other's vulnerabilities as well as their strengths, and you build a relationship on that. And so I think some people do feel they have to put a tough face on for the public. And even in my career in radio, the most successful television and radio personalities are the ones that have shared their vulnerabilities with their audience. And so there's a connection there because I think you can relate more to somebody when they talk about things that scare them rather than relate on things that make you strong or the things that don't frighten you.
Exactly. That's so true. Because I share, I mean, everything is in that book. I share everything from my driving issues I have. I don't like calling it a driving phobia because I feel like phobia just makes it worse. I don't feel comfortable driving on big highways. I don't like speed at all. And I've struggled with this for years. And I've kept it secret back and forth. I didn't want people to know that I wasn't driving. I only drove on small roads. But at one point, I'm like, you know what? Whatever. That doesn't, you know, determine who I am. And I put it in my book. So things like that, people come up to me and they're like, oh, how can you be, you know, so strong enough to share that with the world? I'm like, because that doesn't define me.
Right.
Because I came to the realization one day that I'm not the only one on the face of the earth who's scared of driving on big highways. There's actually many of us. I've researched and I'm like, you know what, let me put it out there.
Yes.
So that, you know, there may be a 20-year-old girl who's feeling like, oh, I'm not part of the pack because I can't drive. Maybe I'll change somebody's life. So little things like that, I'm like, you know what, that doesn't define me. That's not who Iyabo is. Mm-hmm. I can still live a really good life without being able to drive like everybody else.
When you share something like that, you bring out that in other people, because it's so funny that you say that. Now, I can drive, but I notice the older I get, the less I enjoy it. And if you don't mm-hmm. live in Atlanta, the interstate system here has become a free-for-all. So people just lose their minds on this interstate system. And such defensive driving. And so I told a friend the other day, I said, I am not going to be the senior citizen that you have to rip the keys out of my hand. I will voluntarily, probably before I hit that age, because I don't enjoy it either. And so I can understand why somebody is so stress is probably not the right word, but there is so anxious about doing it that you wouldn't mm-hmm. do it at all. And so,
yeah,
and I'm not surprised that there are more than more people, because especially if you live in an urban environment, I think everybody gets to the point where they're turned off by having to do that, because it's not enjoyable. Driving is not enjoyable for a lot of people.
No, it's not. And it got worse for me when I moved to Atlanta, like you said, because of the enormous highways. I was fine in England. Actually, in New York, I was fine. And I got here and I just froze and I'm like, okay, what am I going to do with myself? I have to get around. And I got around. And now with Uber, you know what? It's so easy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I have
it's
a friend.
It's so much easier now. Yes.
Yeah. I have a friend that drives for Uber, and I asked him, what is the most surprising thing that you found? And he said, how many people use Uber to go to work? And so he's like, but if you think about it, mm-hmm. it's brilliant because it's cheaper. Even paying for Uber is cheaper than having a car and having to get insurance and having to get gas. And so he's like, he became more of a shuttle for people going to and from work every day than mm-hmm. somebody that was going out doing anything social.
Exactly. And it's more relaxing. You sit in the back of the car. You're not like having to deal with road rage. By the time you get to the office, you're in a bad mood already. You just sit there, you read a book, or you chat with the driver, or just, you know, enjoy the view, and you get where you're going in good spirit. So that's the strength of vulnerability. So those are things people have told me about my book, about how I shared about my marriage and about my relationship and all that, and how I'm in the dating field and all that. So I was open because I don't have anything to hide, and that's what mm-hmm. that's my father's passing, that's what he brought out in me. I just had this peace inside me, like, okay, I need to just share with the world, and I did, and I'm glad I did, because I've had a lot of positive feedback from people.
When you share something that you're insecure about, and you tell me if this has been your case, that the fear is that people are, you fear that people are going to give you a hard time about it or tease you about it, but then you, in the end, you realize that you gave yourself much more of a hard time about it in your mind than anyone ever would in public. And so once you share what it is that stresses you out, you actually feel better because you realize you were your own worst critic at the end.
Yes, that is true. Honestly, that is very true. There'll always be that small percentage of people who are looking to pounce on other people's insecurities. Those are not the ones we're talking about. But for the most part, people are good people, mm-hmm. and they will empathize with you, and they will, you know, let you know that's not a big deal. You're still a great person. You know, we couldn't care less. But then, like you said, we give ourselves a hard time. And that's, again, what I talk to girls about in my office. That, look, you're beautiful on the inside. That one girl who is teasing you about your looks, she has major insecurities. So why don't you just ignore her, leave her by the side, and be friends with the other girls who are more positive? Mm-hmm. Because this isn't about you. This is about the other person. Yes, so I agree with you. We amplify and exaggerate these things that we think make us not worthy. And meanwhile, people don't really care. They're not even noticing those things,
right.
But we are noticing them. You have to teach people how you want to be viewed in any kind of relationship, whether it's a romantic relationship or just a platonic one. The way you carry yourself, if you're asking your boyfriend or your friend every day, how do I look? Do you think this dress looks good? Or do you think my hair should be gray or white or orange? Then you're not being confident. Just you dress the way, that's what I tell girls. Stop asking for opinions.
Right.
Dress in what makes you look fantastic, feel good, and just show up. Stop asking people, do I look good? Because what if they tell you you don't look good? Are you going to be able to handle the answer?
Right, right. Well, it is from their opinion, too.
Yeah. So that's what I tell them. You just do what makes you feel fantastic from the inside out and just show up. And then that's how you teach people how to view you and how to see who you are. Because if you're asking for opinions, are you actually ready to take those answers? And are you going, do you now want to change and transform yourself into something else? Probably not.
Right, right. Well, let me ask you about body image, Dr. Iyabo, because it's so funny. Every woman, I'm assuming, has a body part or parts, you know, certain parts of their body they're insecure about. And so I certainly do. And then it wasn't until I grew older that my fear or my anxiety about that body part actually came true. So I'm, you know, gained weight as I got older and that body part got bigger. And I remember thinking that I have been insecure about this section of my body since I was probably 14. And the reason is because of my older sister and my mother complaining about that part of their body. It was almost like it was suggested to me and I spent my whole life worrying about it. And then now that it is out of shape, there's a part of me, it's like, you know what? Well now, hey, here it is. Now I'm going to let it go. Like I got to stop because I adopted that, that insecurity. So do you find that with girls that someone else, like you just said, is telling them something about their bodies and that's what makes them insecure?
Yes, absolutely. 1000%. That's where it starts from. Little girls are not born with the notion of, oh, my arm's too big, my butt's too wide. They're not born with that. So somebody says it to them over and over, or somebody's looking in the mirror and making negative comments about themselves and they pick up on it. And that's why I always tell women, we have to be careful. You can ask my two daughters, I like go overboard with, oh, I'm so beautiful, I dance in front of the mirror, I'm like, oh, look at me. I'm very particular about making sure that I show them that I'm confident and positive about the way I look, because they will pick up on these things. Or eating disorders, or, you know, not eating, starving, drinking water all day, and then the daughters think that's the right thing to do. So I'm calling all mothers out there and all, you know, older people, please be careful around your children. Be very careful. What we should talk about in front of our daughters is being healthy. And being healthy doesn't mean starving. You can, you know, just eating a balanced diet. Show them research. Eat your fruits, eat your veggies. Yes, drink water, but you can have a treat once in a while. Doesn't mean you can't have a slice of cake once a week or a couple times a week. And then we teach them about exercise, and we teach them about not sitting in front of devices every day and being inactive. So that's how we should talk to our daughters, but not telling them about, oh, you know, I don't like my arm, it's too flabby, or my thighs are too big. So there's a way we can talk to our daughters about being healthy and not focusing on body parts, right? You get what I'm saying, Melissa?
Absolutely.
At least that's what I do. Yeah, that's what I do. There was a time I used to drink Diet Coke all the time, and then I stopped and I told my daughters, well, that's not a good habit. The sugar in it is not even good for you. So you can talk about scientific and just proven ways of making yourself healthy, not about different body parts and shapes and all that. Even if you're dealing with it, maybe talk to your adult friends about it and not to your little kids.
My mother, bless her heart, she's a rock, and she rarely complains about herself. But I have heard her talk about it's my stomach. I remember the moment I was laying out. I was 14 and I was with a buddy of mine, and we were laying out, and I remember my sister coming out to talk to us, and she's older, and she made some comment about, well, you better enjoy it while you got it, because you won't have that stomach for very long. And that was the moment. From that point on, I always focused on my stomach. Now, I probably have other body parts that I would be insecure about, that other people are insecure about, that I'm not. And that's what fascinates me, is why is that different? Well, it's because of, like you said, the suggestions that other people make from the outside. So being happy from the inside out also includes not caring about what other people think, because they can't be that much of an influence on you like that.
They cannot. And everybody has something they dealing with. Just what I always want to tell girls is, nobody is perfect. Everybody you're seeing on social media and on TV and everything, first of all, they have like 100 makeup artists making them up. They have somebody doing their hair. They have somebody helping them exercise and all that. So, you know, no, but if you see them in broad daylight, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful of anyone, but even if you see the most beautiful woman on TV in broad daylight next to you, she's probably just going to look like you.
Mm-hmm, right.
So don't think because she's all made up and she looks, she's going to look, if you bump into her at Starbucks one morning, she's probably going to look like you with no makeup on, with glasses, with her hair all over the place. So it's okay. It's okay not to be perfect because nobody is. And if you had the whole team, you probably would look like her. So just give yourselves a break. But I honestly just wanted to put out there to people that stop asking about people's opinions about, or especially when you're dating. If you're asking your boyfriend every second, do you think I look good? Do you think that looks fine? Or do you think, then you're probably not with the right person. Maybe he's making you feel insecure. Now, if you're with somebody who loves you the way you are, when you show up, you don't need to ask questions about, is my arm too big in this, or does this color look good on me? He's just going to, he or she, whether you're heterosexual or same-sex relationship, he or she is just going to give you an embrace and hug you regardless of how you look. But if you're having to ask, that's where that, because I find that a lot of girls like to look for opinions from their friends and from people their relationships with, and that just completely breaks their heart because they get the answer and then they dwell on that for so long and they focus on this one body part and they're just trying to make it perfect because this one person who is important to them told them it's not good enough. So asking for opinions, you have to be ready for. I've never been one. Maybe it's because of the way I was raised. My mom, I told you, was super confident. She just had her own style and she showed up and everybody else actually tried to be like her. So I think I saw her doing that. Mm-hmm. And I just develop my style. I show up and I just blend in with everyone and I don't ask for opinions. That's the way to go. Because who doesn't? I have body parts I'm not completely happy about in my body. But right now I don't even care anymore. When I was younger, I would try to wear clothes to like hide. I didn't really like my arms. I felt they were too big. Mm-hmm. And I never wanted to wear anything sleeveless. But now I wear sleeveless clothes all the time. And I don't really care. I try to eat healthy. I exercise. And I know I'm doing the best to my body from inside out. And mm-hmm. I just put my head up and I enjoy life. Yeah.
I think there's an energy that resonates to other people that we don't pay attention to, that I think there's a reason why some people have just this energy, this positive energy, and then there's some people you kind of want to avoid. And I think it has far more to do mm-hmm. with their, again, energy they're putting out rather than how they look.
Because right.
Some people.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's why even on my social media, on Instagram, I don't have all pictures of me just made up. I have some with no makeup, just so that people can see how I look without makeup and how I look with makeup, so they know that I'm actually, I'm not perfect.
It's important
to show those two. Like I posted one picture this morning mm-hmm. with me sitting in front of Starbucks with my dog, with my glasses on and absolutely no makeup.
Right.
So they know what a yabba looks like with or without makeup.
The older I get, the more I tend to do that too, where it's you love me as I am. And I think that your point, the word you said about how to some people they're not enough, I think that, or they're not good enough. I think that is a great mantra that you have for your life, for anybody, whether it's a romantic relationship, friend relationship, or family relationship, that you have to look at the people around you mm-hmm. and they have to be good enough for you, and then you'll be good enough for them.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You choose. So, you know, people are always trying for people to choose them. You have the power to choose your company. mm-hmm. You have that. There's billions of people in the world. So you have the power to choose your company. Choose people that are positive. Again, I'm not saying I don't want us to be around people who only make you feel good, because we still need people around to teach us lessons. So, you know, when I say that, I make sure that I qualify what I mean. If you're trying to be around people who only tell you good things and you don't want to listen to some things you may have to work on, then that's bad. But don't be around people who pull you down all the time, who are talking about your exterior and pulling you down.
Right.
Yes, you should look for mentors. You should look for people who will tell you some truth. Like, I'm open to lessons. I learn every day. I learn from my staff at work. I learn from medical students who are younger than me. I learn every day. But that doesn't mean that you want to be around people who always pull you down. So mm-hmm. you choose your company. If you have friends who are always gossiping about other people, who are materialistic, who the only thing they want to talk about is the latest bag they just bought or about people's body parts. You shouldn't be with that company.
Right.
You need to find another group of friends to be with. So you choose your company. Don't let people choose you. You have that strength in you to choose who you want to spend your time with, because that's where you're going to become. That's where your thoughts are going to go. You're going to go with the thoughts of these people you're spending time with. So we have to be careful about choosing a company, mm-hmm. really carefully.
One last question before we end our wonderful conversation. Again, Dr. Iyabo, in her book, Permanent Happiness, which we'll have a link to on shepersistedshow.com. What advice, if you could go back to like the little, your inner child or yourself as a little girl, you've had positive mm-hmm. influences from your parents and other people in your life, but what would you tell your younger self about how to live her life? If there's anything that you know now that you wish you knew then?
The number one thing I would say is, yeah, but trust your instincts. Mm-hmm. That's the number one thing I would say to my young self, because I feel like I think we all do, maybe some of us have a little bit stronger like instinct than others, but every first thought that I've had on a decision I should make or something I should do or not do has usually been the correct one. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I go with another decision and then I'm like, oh, yeah, well, you see, you should have gone with your instincts. So I would tell my younger self, yeah, but trust your instincts.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make hasty decisions. Think about that one instinct. Don't think about it too much where you miss out on it. But if your gut is telling you something, trust it, because it's probably a voice from a higher power somewhere. It's a voice from God. I know not everybody believes in God. I have to, you know, but you know, it's probably a voice from somewhere trying to lead you, because honestly, the world is on our side. The world, God, the world, super, any higher power out there is on our side, wants us to make the right decision. So that's what I would say first to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Trust your inner instinct, trust your gut. And the way you do, because people are like, how do I know? What's this gut thing? What's this instinct?
Mm-hmm.
You have to practice spending time alone. You have to practice quiet time, time of reflection, and then you'll really be able to build up on that gut instinct. But there's many, but that would be my number one thing that I would say to myself. Yeah, but trust yourself. You know what to do.
And sometimes we don't know where that instinct is coming from. So, I mean, it's like you said, I'm open to all possibilities, and it could be something trying to tell you something. I'm trying to make it easier on you.
It could be.
You know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because there's always that voice telling us inside of us, do it this way, but then we want to go with the popular notion. We want to go with whatever it is that other people are doing. And then we just make the wrong decision. And then 1 year, 2 years, 5 years after, we're like, oh, I should have gone with that first gut instinct. It happens mm-hmm. all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Iyabo, before I let you go, let me ask, because somebody will be asking, if they live in the Atlanta area, are you taking new patients or are you full?
Yes.
You are taking new patients. Okay, cool. Well, if you're in Atlanta, all the information will be on shepersistedshow.com. I didn't want to put you on the spot, but you know, I know some people who hear you will probably be like, I want my child in that doctor's hands.
Yes, yes, yeah, and I'll be glad to. They can call the office for appointments, and I'll be happy to see them. There's two other doctors in the practice, but if they specifically want to see me, they can call and ask for me, and they'll put them on my schedule.
All right, fantastic. Well, best of luck with your book, Permanent Happiness, and thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Thanks so much, Melissa. I really enjoyed this. Thanks for having me.
And like I said, we will have all of Dr. Iyabo's contact information, social media, book information on our website, shepersistedshow.com. So thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. You can always go to shepersistedshow.com. You can always go to iTunes. We're also on iTunes. You can go to our Facebook page. There's a Facebook page for She Persisted Show is what you're looking for. Plus, Progressive Voices. It's a free app to download, and there's all kinds of great shows on there as well as She Persisted. Do something special for yourself. And just like Dr. Iyabo talked about, how about we not look in the mirror and look at our bad parts? How about we look in the mirror and talk about, you know what? You look great today. Damn, you look good. Girl, you is fine. Whatever you want to say. You need to start saying that to yourself, because your children are listening. They really are. And I got to tell you the story I told her about my sister in particular. Like, I love my sister and I know she didn't mean to do any harm, but I have been self-conscious about the same place on my body, and it has given me the most trouble throughout my life. I got to tell you, that gut area that she talked about is where all my illnesses have been and where all my troubles have been throughout my existence. So is it something that I put such negative feelings toward that I've made it sick? I don't know. I'm open to all those possibilities, but it could be something that I destroyed myself by taking someone's word too seriously. So, yeah, just look in the mirrors, ladies, and love yourself. You got to learn to be your own best friend. Would you say the words you say to yourself about your body to your best friend? Of course not. So don't say it to yourself. And do something for yourself that's going to make you smile. Just give yourself a little treat. Reward yourself for just being alive. And we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.